Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Chris Myers and Lorenzo Pasquini. How are you guys?
Very well, Great, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Just so everybody knows which one's which, Chris, you've got the English accent.
I'm English, yeah.
And Lorenzo, you've got a sort of a...
Italian
accent. Sounds a wee bit French to me, but it's Italian. So, excellent, that's perfect. So we're in Chateau Palmer.
Chateau Palmer.
In the Margaux.
In the Margaux appellation, which is left bank in the Médoc in Bordeaux. So Margaux is the southernmost appellation in the Médoc. So it's a 55-hectare property, so we produce between 15 and 20,000 cases of...
Chris, what's your role at Chateau Palmer?
I am an export director for Europe, Africa and Middle East. So basically there are three of me, one person who's based in New York who looks after the Americas, one person who's based here who looks after Asia and Pacific, and I do the rest of the world.
Perfect. And Lorenzo?
I'm assistant winemaker here, and I'm one of the two assistants of Sabrina Perme, which is a technical director, and I look after all the trials, the experiments on the vinification and aging process, and all the quality control.
Perfect. We're going to talk about some of the trials and R&D that you guys are doing here. There's some that sounded quite interesting. But before we get into that, can we just get a quick profile, probably whoever's most appropriate. Chris, I think, probably, isn't it? I'm sure you spend a lot of time talking to people about Chateau Palmer. Can we just get a quick overview of maybe the history of Chateau Palmer and how you guys see yourself positioned?
Chateau Palmer used to be called Domaine de Gasque. It belonged to a big French family called the de Gasque. Madame de Gasque sold the property in 1814 to Colonel Charles Palmer, who gave his name to the property. So that was 200 years ago, celebrating our 200th anniversary.
He sounds English.
Charles. Very English. Charles Palmer was ended up a major general in the British Army. He was a member of Parliament in Bath. So he bought the property in 1814 and spent a lot of money in the vineyard, buying plots of land. Spent a lot of time promoting Palmer in the UK, which is why Palmer's so well known now in the UK. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he spent probably a bit too much money and went bankrupt in 1843. And the French banks got the property back in 1843, and they owned it for 10 years until two French brothers called the Perrers, who are French bankers, they bought the property in 1853 and owned it till 1938.
Oh, okay, for quite some time, yeah.
They went through quite a few problems with phylloxera and the war and various problems, and they had to sell the property in 1938 to four French families, the Miaille family, the Ginesté, the Malabès, and Sichel family. Yep. And the two remaining families who own the property today are the Malabès and Sichel.
Okay, I was actually visiting Sichel estate just before we came over, actually, in another estate in Margaux, talking to Ben. You're saying that that the original owner bought it,
the interesting thing is that Charles Palmer went bankrupt in 1843.
Yeah, just missing the classification.
Just missing the classification by 12 years. But, yeah. But the Perrer brothers bought the property in 1853, 2 years before the classification.
Yeah.
The problem that the Palmer had was that because the French banks owned it for 10 years previous to that, they invested no money at all into the chateau. All they did was sell land. Sell plots of land, as banks do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They invested nothing at all into the winemaking techniques or into buying specific plots. So when the Perrer brothers brought the property in 1853, the wine was very good and very well known, but it wasn't as well known as some of the first growths today, as Aubryon, etc., in the UK. So the Perrer brought the property in 1853, and the classification was in 1855, 2 years later. So didn't have enough time to invest and increase the quality of the wine in 2 years. So when the classification was done in 1855, Palmer was classed as a third growth and not a second or a first.
Yeah, yeah. Well, third growth is pretty good, though.
Which is good. I mean, to be honest, the whole classification process was only done on price.
Yeah, it was like a load of merchants, you know, how much can you flog this wine for?
Exactly. It was more the first growths now, Aubryon, Lafitte, Latour were very, very well known in London. There was a huge market. Because there was a huge market, the price was high.
Yep.
And because the price was high, they were first.
Yeah, yeah.
Palmer was the same thing. The price was slightly lower. So it was a third growth.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose that Charles Palmer did a lot of work in terms of raising the brand awareness. It could have been worse if someone else had done it and just sold some wine.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Charles Palmer invested a lot of time and money into the whole property and especially into the vines. So thanks to him, we're a third growth.
Yeah.
And not a fourth or a fifth or outside the whole classification system, which would be even worse.
Yeah. Just to recap, from my understanding of the 1855 classification, there was classifications before that, there was classifications after that. The thing about the 1855 was it was for the Paris show, wasn't it?
It was for the exposition that was in Paris. Napoleon wanted to classify all the wines into the 1855 Paris exhibition.
That's when they built the Eiffel Tower for that, wasn't
Absolutely
it?
Absolutely right.
I went up the Eiffel Tower on Saturday, actually. So,
okay.
So it was quite a big, important exhibition for
Huge
Paris.
Exhibition. It was a few years after the one in the UK. And they wanted to classify basically French agriculture in general, and obviously the wines came into the whole system. So the French courtier were asked to classify the most famous and most expensive wines in France or in Bordeaux so as to have a classification system to show the wines in this exhibition.
Yeah, these are the best, these are the next best, whatever.
Exactly.
And it was done on price, which is...
It's done on price.
It's not a bad way of doing it because people don't normally pay a lot of money for rubbish, but by the same token, things that are more popular can be more expensive.
Yeah. And to be honest, the classification now, we could have a lengthy discussion about is the classification still true to this day about the whole our first really worse, the best and the fifth, the not as good as the first. I think 80% of the wines, I think they stick the classification. I think they're worth their own classification. Mm. So I think it's true to this day.
Success breeds success, though. If you're making a lot of money, you can invest that money.
True.
You know, we've just been through your winery and had a quick look around and... You've got a lot of fancy kit there that maybe someone who's not so classified wouldn't have, so they don't have the same options and therefore have the same ability to produce the same quality of wines, not necessarily because they've got much poorer soils, it's just they don't have the money to do the investment. And that's, you know, you invest, you make.
Also the fact that we have these two families who are heavily into their wine and winemaking processes and want to reinvest money into the property. I think without these two families, if it belonged to a huge conglomerate and just looking to pump money out, we wouldn't be able to invest that kind of money back into winemaking and into winemaking facilities, into the vineyard.
Yeah.
So I think having these two major families who own the property is a huge advantage for Palmer.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the classifications, a lot of people talk about some wines being better than their ranking and some wines not being as good and some being better. And there is a sort of movement around, but there's a wine company called Livex. Every year they sort of publish what the rankings should be based on the prices of producers now.
Of their transactions, yeah.
Yeah, then transactions in terms of the revenue. And they do generally follow the 1855 classification, but I'm never convinced it's a chicken or egg situation. Is, you know, if you started from a level playing field now, everybody being exactly the same, how things would turn out? Because I'm not convinced that you'd end up with exactly the same classification.
Yeah, I think you'd end up with approximately the same classification. I think that obviously there are some properties, some famous properties that are fifth, that are worth at least third or second growth. Mm-hmm. The other way around as well.
Yeah.
But I think, as I said before, I think 80% of the classification is true to this day, and it should stick. And the classification will never, ever be redone.
Although, you know, if you're a wealthy banker and you've got the ear of the president, you can get yourself bumped up to first growth.
That was a big political thing. Reclassification has been done twice. Once with Contamela, because they forgot to put it into fifth growth. So that came from nothing to fifth growth. And second with Mouton Rothschild in 73, when it was classed, went from second to first. That's a political thing. I won't start talking about that.
Okay.
But Wright Bank, for example, in Saint-Emilion, they had the reclassification of the Saint-Emilion every 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's always very, very complicated.
It's a
complete mess.
Yeah, I'm going to go we'll go over to Saint-Emilion tomorrow and have a bit of a guess about it.
It'd be interesting to talk about it because it's a personal thing. I think the 1855 classification is a historical thing, and why not keep it? Why not keep it? Obviously, Palmer would prefer to be second or first.
Yeah.
Why not? But we're a third, and we're happy being a third. It's more the style of wine we're making and the quality of wine we're making more than the classification itself.
We're going to try a couple of glasses in a minute, actually. But before we get into that, what I thought was interesting about 1855 is that a lot of the vineyards have changed ownership. So the vineyards that maybe Parma had, I don't know if it's Parma or not, but I know some of the chateaus have got different vineyards now to what they had when they were classified. They're growing different grape varieties from when they were classified. So a lot of stuff has changed, but not the classification. I always find that quite funny.
No comment. That's why I say I'm at kind of I don't think the classification should change, but there are kind of strange things that have happened. Mm. Properties, you say, having different vineyards and buying different plots and etc. And planting different grape varieties. That's probably the negative side of the coin of the classification is that it hasn't changed and properties have changed.
Yeah.
But then again, if the customer's prepared to pay that price for that wine, if he's happy with it, then the customer's happy. That's the main thing.
Yeah, no, that's right. We've been talking about 1855 classification, quite important. An interesting other side effect is how these chateaus now sell their wine, because traditionally you sell your wine to a merchant and then the merchant sort of sells the wine to the customers. But a lot of the top chateaus, they don't go down that route. They go down what's called the en-premier system. Do you want to just give us a really quick overview about what en-premier is, Chris?
So en-premier is, Americans call it futures market. It's been going since the early 80s. I think 82 was the first vintage of en-premier.
1982.
In the olden days, en-premier was to sell the wine just after the wine's gone into cask, about a year or two before it's bottled, and it pays for the future vintage. So that's the whole system, was basically to bring money into the chateaus each year to guarantee to pay for the future vintage. Things have now changed because the properties need pretty less, more cash rich than they used to be in the olden days.
Yeah.
For example, a customer will buy a wine en-premier to guarantee the cheapest price that he paid before the wine was bottled. Mm-hmm. And also if the customer wants to buy an Imperial, for example, guarantee that his wine was bottled in a 6-litre bottle.
Oh, you can choose the size?
You can choose the size. That's to be honest, actually, the main thing today is actually just to choose the size of the bottle that your wine is going to be bottled in. Also to guarantee the price, but you can choose the Magnums, Double Magnums, Jeroboams, Imperials and larger, and they'll be bottled specifically for you.
Okay.
Because chateaus don't really bottle large formats. They'll bottle Magnums, maybe Double Magnums. But bigger than that, they might bottle a few, but hardly any. So that guarantees your bottle size. The en-premier market nowadays is tough, especially vintages like 2013, which we're tasting now.
Well, we will taste.
We'll taste now, we'll taste soon. Where the market's tough, complicated vintages like 2011 and 2012, where the en-premier market's been tough because there's not a huge amount of demand. 2013 comes along, demand's still pretty minimal. So the en-premier market is not as buoyant as it used to be in the olden days.
Yeah, yeah. Some people say that's because the chateaus have just racked up the prices of what they're selling. You know, you get a good year, prices go up massively. You know, 05, I remember watching the prices go up in 05, and then they went up. They didn't really come down again when the vintage wasn't quite so good, and then it went up again, and the prices were in 09 and 010, they went stratospheric, and then they didn't really come down again. In the old days, Bordeaux prices used to go up and down with the vintage. So that, I don't know, and also you've got a worldwide recession as well. Movement to China.
It depends the way you want to go. It depends on people hate when I say this, but it's more brand protection. If you can afford to sell a part of your wine en-premier and keep stock back and sell and drip feed the market over the coming years, fine. Some chateaus can afford to do that. Some chateaus can't afford to do it, so they'll yo-yo. So they'll bring their price up to 150 euros and bring it down to 60, up to 120, which depends on the whole marketing process of selling your wine. Some chateaus try and maintain the price as much as possible, maintain that price, maybe not sell everything as much as they want to, but over the years they'll sell that stock as the demand increases.
Yeah, yeah.
At the moment, obviously, the market's not buoyant at all, and there is a recession, as you say. So the en-premier market in 2013 was tough.
Yeah.
Was tough. But yeah. 2014 is coming along, which will be fantastic. So.
Yeah, well, hopefully the weather will be good and you have a great vintage and everybody will want it. There's a whole complicated thing to do with négociants and courtiers. What's the process from Chateau Palmer's point of view? You've got the journalists come in, they taste the wine and they make their comments about it. And then who do you sell to? Do you sell ultimately to the final customer, or what's the middleman process?
It's complicated process from the outside. The chateau will sell via a broker called a courtier to a négociant, We have 22 négociants or wine merchants in Bordeaux who distribute our wine. So we'll sell to the 22 on Primeur. And those 22 négociants will sell worldwide. The advantage for a chateau like Chateau Palmer is that in a matter of seconds, literally seconds, we'll sell to 22 négociants and they'll offer the wine out to all their customers worldwide. So after about 5 minutes, vintage where there's a huge amount of demand, we can sell whatever we want to all four parts of the world.
Yeah, yeah. What about companies like BBR? Are they a négociant or are they buying from the négociant?
No, but BBR are great friends of ours, but they're buying through the system. BBR won't buy direct. They'll buy from one of our 22 négociants.
Yeah, okay. If you want to be a sell Chateau Palmer on Premier, you actually have to go to a négociant and strike a deal with a négociant.
Definitely. We haven't sold a single bottle to anybody apart from négociant. We have requests the whole time from companies abroad or in France and private customers mm-hmm. wanting to buy direct to the chateau. Mm-hmm. But we refuse because the whole system is in place and it works very well.
Yeah.
If a private customer wants to buy a bottle, we'll send him to, if he's in the UK, we'll send him to Berry Brothers, for example. Or if he's an importer abroad, we'll send him to one of our 22 négociants. We'll never, ever sell direct.
Yeah, yeah. The nice thing about that is it means you don't have to worry about a sales force, I suppose. And if a négociant can't sell your wine, then hopefully someone else will. It means that you won't have a big team working for you, though. Or do you have a big team working for you, Chris?
We have the whole property. We have 55 hectares. We have 47 or 48 people working here. Kind of the rule of thumb is one person per hectare for a Cru Class A.
What, sales force or...?
No, that's talking about the whole property itself. Sales force, there are three of us. There's me and two colleagues.
Yes.
But we're not selling. We're helping our... going onto the markets with our négociants to help them or aid them sell our wine. Yeah.
There's a chateau that's bypassed the négociant system, haven't they? They're just recently, that was this year and last year, I think they...
Chateau Latour?
Yeah, Chateau
Latour. No, the Chateau Latour haven't bypassed the négociants. They've stopped selling on Primeur, and they're now selling vintages which they think are drinkable. Mm-hmm. So they've released 96 and 2004 onto the market, still going via négociants.
And just one last question. My understanding is that when you release on Premier, you often have multiple tranches. So the first tranche is supposed to be the best value, and then the next tranche, and the next tranche, and the next tranche. Is that how it works? How do those tranches work?
Again, depends on the vintage.
Does it?
Depends on the vintage. For the last few vintages, we've had second tranches in 2009, 2010. 11, 12, 13, we just had one tranche.
Yeah, okay. And the price goes up each tranche if you do have multiple tranches?
We have maximum two tranches, so the price is normally 10-15% difference between first and second tranche.
Yeah, yeah, okay. All right. Okay then, Chris, I think, and Lorenzo, who's been very quiet. Sorry about that, Lorenzo.
For once, yeah.
We're going to try some wine in the next interview. So
great.
We'll give you a chance to have your say then.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank Cheers. You.